University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Margaret Farley, professor at Yale University Divinity School, speaking on the topic, Problems and Possibilities in Personal Commitment. The Gilbert L. Stark Professor of Christian Ethics at the University's Divinity School, Farley has done considerable work in the areas of social, feminist, and medical ethics, and the history of Christian ethics. She is the author of Personal Commitments, Beginning, Keeping, Changing, and numerous journal articles. She received her master's degree in philosophy from the University of Detroit. Her doctorate in religious studies, with emphasis in religious and philosophical ethics, is from Yale University. She's been on staff at Yale since 1971.
Margaret Farley is the Gilbert L. Stark Professor of Christian Ethics at Yale University. She received her doctorate in religious studies from Yale and has been a member of the Yale faculty since 1971. She is the author of numerous books and articles, most recently, Personal Commitments, Beginning, Keeping, Changing, which was published by Harper & Row last fall. But Margaret Farley is more than that. She is a woman of courage, one of the women religious who signed the New York Times ad in 1983 calling for dialogue in the Catholic Church on the issue of abortion. She is a woman of wisdom. Her door at Yale has a sign-up sheet that is constantly filled with names of people seeking her counsel. She is a woman of commitment. She is here in Lincoln this weekend to preach the sermon at the ordination of Jane Ellison into the ministry of the United Church of Christ at First Plymouth. The ordination of women in ministry is still a historic occasion for women and a battle yet to be won in many churches, including the church to which Margaret Farley has made a commitment. Margaret Farley will be on campus today for a talk-back session in Callan Conference Center at 11 o'clock and again at Philosophy Club at 4 p.m. in the Alabaster Lounge of Old Main. All are welcome. She will be having lunch in the Conestoga Room of the Student Center at noon, and again, all are welcome. Sunday Night Live will discuss, are you ready for commitment or do you just want to get married? On Sunday night at 6 p.m. in the Hearth Room. Again, all are welcome. Margaret Farley is welcomed here by the women's organization Reaching Tangible Horizons, otherwise known as WORTH, the Women's Institute for Theology, also known as WIT, and especially by the Forum Committee. I ask you to join me in welcoming Margaret Farley.
I feel a little like I'm on a life support system here, so... whoever is running this. Oh. One of the things Elaine didn't tell you about me is that I was born and raised in the Midwest, that is in Minnesota, so I always feel like I'm coming home when I head to the Midwest. This morning, in a short period of time, I want to try to say something about problems and possibilities of commitment. By commitment, I suppose, in a sense, in the context of many of you, I'm including questions of commitment to work, to whether or not one's going to go to college, to what college one is going to what one is going to major in college. If I can do anything to help you with this, why, let me know. But also commitment to ideas, to values, to projects, and central love commitments to marriage, to family, to faith, to churches. But regarding all of these commitments and many others that you could think of, about 15 years ago, it was fashionable to question whether we should make commitments at all, whether it was possible to make them, and if we made them, whether it was possible to keep them. Everybody sort of thought, well, yes, some commitments might still be important. After all, we still should sign rental agreements for our apartments, or we should still indicate that we're going to pay the mortgage on our home or the monthly payment on our cars. There should still be employer-employee contracts. We should still try to make international treaties, etc. But regarding the central loves in our lives, vocational choices, major relationships, it all was a matter of doubt at that time. And there were a number of reasons for that, a number of problems. On the one hand, people had experience of what looked like too much commitment, sort of totalistic commitment. It was the age of idealism, and people committed themselves absolutely, totally to, on the one hand, fascist movements, on the other hand, left-wing anti-war movements, to idealistic, absolutized projects of all sorts. And those who made that kind of total commitment sooner or later found that there was something disappointing in what they had given their whole selves to. It was inevitable that some kind of disillusionment set in. And that led to sort of the pendulum swinging the other way. Maybe we shouldn't be making commitments at all. Or on the other hand, people made commitments, lifelong commitments, whether in marriage or friendship, faith context, promised to love one another. And that began to be called into question because obviously not everyone was very successful at it. And even if one did manage to live out till the end of one's life, lifelong commitments, still there seemed something inauthentic about making commitments that then were kept just by sort of gritting your teeth and being dutiful. It seemed something of a contradiction to give a kind of law to love. Why not every day spontaneously choose to ratify one's love rather than say, well, I said I would and so I would, and so on. And everybody became aware of not just the changes in our own lives, but rapid cultural change. And situations changing, not only individuals changing. New opportunities opening up. It was also a time when we grew in our understanding of the need to be committed to ourselves in some way, not just to others. The human growth potential, etc., was emphasized. All of this led people with a kind of experience of powerlessness or a sense of having made mistakes or a sense of realistic awareness of the dangers of setting limits to one's life led everyone to question making commitments almost in principle. Today, things have changed again. At least in theory, in principle, hardly anybody questions the importance of making commitments. Theorists like Robert Bella and his colleagues write about what our society needs is commitment. And people in their personal individual lives want to make commitments. We're at a point where sort of a longing to make commitments. This is the way that you can achieve intimacy. This is the way you can belong somewhere. This is the way you can find meaning in your life, whether it's in marriage or through parenting or in some form of community. Or this is the way to change the world. Somebody needs to take responsibility for anti-racism and anti-sexism and bringing about peace in the world and so on. It seems not so much to be a question in principle, but it's still a question in practice. That is to say, it's still a problem of how we're going to manage to keep the commitments that we do, in fact, find ourselves wanting to make and making. We anguish over whether the marriages we undertake will end in the divorce court like everyone else's that we know, whether the faith commitments that we make in churches will eventually turn out to be so disillusioning that we cannot sustain them with any degree of integrity on our parts, etc. Or even if we do manage to keep the commitments, whether we can keep them alive and not just sort of dead weight burdens that we carry along with us, reducing them to a matter of sheer law or duty. Whether, as our options continue to widen, it does still make sense for us to narrow them through commitments. And some persons have even the kind of problem which I call overcommitment. That is, no problem making commitment, sustaining commitment, but we make so many of them that the claims besiege us in a way that we simply cannot be faithful to them all, at least on a day-to-day basis. and we're faced with questions of which ones take priority in certain circumstances and over a whole lifetime. Well, this morning, in the time that we have together, I don't intend to address all of these questions, but I want to approach them by making some comments in four general areas. One is the meaning of commitment, what it is we do when we make a commitment, after all. Secondly, why we continue to make commitments, whatever dangers or limitations we see in them. Thirdly, what the limits are that we must acknowledge in our obligations that we undertake when we make commitments. And lastly, whether there is any wisdom to be gained as to how we might sustain the commitments that we do, in fact, make. So first of all, the meaning of commitment. What in the world do we do when we make a commitment? What is it to commit ourselves? And to even make observations on this in a brief period of time, I'm going to ask you to simply think about your own experience in this regard. After all, everybody, by the time you've reached the age that you are here in this room, you've made some kind of commitments, whether trivial ones or profound ones. And you're probably at least thinking of profound ones, even if you haven't made any at this point. When you think generally of your experience of commitment, you may think about commitments you've made to ideas, to values, to institutions, to certain courses of action, to persons. But to narrow our focus for a moment, I'm going to ask you to think about your experience of commitments to persons, not because those are the only kinds of commitments we make, maybe not for you, even the most important ones up to this point, but they do serve as a kind of prime case. If we make explicit commitments to persons, sometimes known as promises, we know we're doing it. And so it's kind of a paradigm. If you can get clear on what you're doing in that case, it helps understand all sorts of other commitments. Now, if you think about any commitments you make, then all I have to do is say, well, now, what were you doing? Or what are you doing? And let me suggest something of what it might be that you're doing, and you can test it out against your experience, see if it makes sense or not. You might end up saying, well, that's not what I think it is at all. That's fine, but let's think about it together for a moment. What do we do when we make a commitment, when we make a promise? We say, I give my word to you. But what do we give when we give our word to someone? Well, somehow it has to do with a future action. I promise to bring you a book tomorrow, or I promise to love you for the rest of my life. I promise to visit you in the hospital as long as you're sick. I give you my word about that. Well, one way of trying to get clear on what that is to distinguish it from other actions we take that regard the future. Making a commitment, a promise, for example, is not like making a prediction. Because in a prediction, I'm not responsible to do what it is I predict I will do. I may be right or wrong about my prediction. I predict that I'll come every day to see you in the hospital. Well, it may or may not happen, but it doesn't imply a responsibility, unless I'm a weather forecaster and people hold me responsible sometimes. But it's not, it seems to me, even the same as making a resolution. I resolve to give up smoking, or I resolve to do my homework on time, or I resolve to go on a diet, or I resolve to be a better kind of friend, etc. In the sense that I'm using the term resolution, I do undertake an obligation, but there's a sense in which the obligation is just to myself. I resolve to give up smoking. My obligation is to be faithful to my own decision, and my integrity. I said I would do it, I'm going to do it. I said to myself I would do it, I'm going to do it. What I'm trying to focus on in talking about promises or commitments in the sense that I'm talking about right now is something that involves an obligation. I undertake an obligation, but it's not just to myself. Somehow I give my word to you. I undertake an obligation that is not just to myself, but is to you. Well, what more could we say about that? The word commitment etymologically comes from the Latin, you know any Latin, mitto or mittere, to send. Somehow I send something somewhere. I commit something to you. I send my word into you. Sometimes we use the word commit in another kind. We say we commit, somebody's committed to prison, or commit something to the elements. Or it implies being placed somewhere. I give you my word. The word stands for the real in the speaker that is somehow placed somewhere else. I give you my word. Somehow I place myself in your hands. My word no longer just calls to me from myself. If I've made a promise to you, a commitment to you, my word now calls to me from you. A sign of that is that we try to express it in certain ways. We try to incarnate in certain ways. Think of examples. Sometimes we give concrete things as a sign that that we want ourselves to be held in claim. If you've ever been arrested for good things like protesting against nuclear missiles or something like that, but if you've ever been arrested and had the opportunity to post bail or get somebody else to post bail for you, posting bail is a way in which you put money there that says, I will show up for my trial, for my arraignment. Now, the money is what? It's a sign of my word. But it's a sign of my word in a way that I concretely know that you're holding on to my word in a way that I'm going to lose something if I don't do what I say I'm going to do. The money is still my money, or a bondsperson's money somehow that I am somehow liable for in any case. Let's say it's my money. What I give when I give my word, it's not like giving a gift. I give you my money, my gift, you say thanks, and off you go. No, no. The bail money is my money. But I give it to you as a sign that I will do what I say because it's mine, but you're holding it. I give you my word. I give you my promise. I make my commitment. I place myself in your hands. But I'm still mine. I still belong to me, but I belong to you in a way that there's a new bond between us that you can call on. Something claims me from beyond me, but it is myself too, in a way. Other ways in which we try to signify that, sometimes our name stands for ourselves. We sign our name to a commitment. You've got my name. You can say, here, you signed this. You gave me your word. You're here. I can call you that. And there are old forms of blood covenanting that were sort of peak instances of interpersonal commitment. There's an old Syriac form of blood covenanting where the partners were required to write in blood on a piece of animal skin their name, and then it was rolled up and given to the blood covenant partner, and the partner wore it on their armband, a sign that somehow the one was given to the other and therefore could be claimed by the other. Or there's some kind, we ceremonialize, ritualize commitments in a way that often we do just do use words. We give our words, but we ritualize the words in a way that says, it's not enough. I want somehow you to feel that my word is coming right into you. There's an old betrothal ceremony in a Berber tribe that goes something like this. It goes on for hours and hours, but one partner says, I have asked you, I have asked you, I have asked from God and from you. And the other responds, I have given you, I have given you, I have given you if you accept my condition. And the response again is, I have accepted, I have accepted, I have accepted and agreed. And it goes on, and it's like, make the words be the real in the speaker, somehow given to the hearer so that a bond is made. Well, we're somehow giving ourselves into another. I make a commitment to you. I give you my word. You hold my word. It now calls to me to be faithful from you. I am bound. I am obligated to do what it is I say I will do, which is a future action of some sort, a future way of being in relation of some sort. But of course, I can't just right now making a free commitment. I can't sort of settle all that for the future. Our power of freedom is not such that we can sort of wind ourselves up like a clock and then it goes. I give you my word. We used to think that, you know, before life became quite as unsettled as it is in our experience. I get married, or I make a vocational commitment, or I enter a certain profession or whatever. That's it. It's like stepping into a circle. There you are. Not anymore. Why? Because it's become clear to us that our freedom isn't that powerful. I can't say, I will do this forever, and there are no more free choices to be made down the line. A sign that our freedom isn't like that is, for example, I can decide tonight that I'm going to get up at 5:30 tomorrow morning. I have some very important things to do, or important friends to see, or a World Series game to go to, or whatever it might be. Tonight, I decide that I'm going to get up at 5 in the morning. I even resolve that I'm going to get up at 5 in the morning. I even promise you that I'm going to get up at 5 in the morning. But for most people, unless I can set up a total conditioning process, for most people, at 5 o'clock when the alarm goes off, I have another choice to make. Now, it's a different kind of choice if I've made a promise, but I still have a choice to make at 5. I can't take care of it all. I can intend to, I can promise to, I can influence that future choice, but I can't do it. My freedom only extends to a present action of making a commitment. Well, what does the commitment do then? In the present, it sets up a new relation. I entrust myself to you. My word is in you. We are in a new relation. And in that relation, we move into the future with all the new choices that have to be made to ratify that one choice, to make the new choices as they arise. Well, why do we do this? I mean, why bother? Why not just make the choices as we go? Well, because we want to influence our future action, even though we can't take care of them ahead of time. We want to influence them. Why? Because we know we have shakable wills, and we have to be able to count on one another. It's a basic structure of human trust. I want some assurance that if you tell me you're going to do such and such, I know you're going to do it. You try to give me assurance by promising. You say, well, of course you can always break your promise. It's true, but you have something to lose if you break your promise. If it's a promise whereby you give me bail money, you stand to lose your bail. If you're just giving me your word, you stand to lose maybe your reputation, maybe my sense of trust in you, maybe your own sense of integrity. You stand to lose something. So we make promises to one another so that we can have some assurance. And so that it strengthens us in doing what, after all, we're not always our best selves. I say, now when I'm at my fullest, best self, I want to do this faithfully. I promise you I'll do this faithfully. I set up a structure whereby I'll do it faithfully. I'll at least be stronger and still won't guarantee I'll do it, but at least I've done what I can to make myself stronger to do it. And we do these things so that there's safety. We make contracts so that we agree not to declare war on each other, or we make contracts so that we can make mutual gain. We're going to be corporation partners together so that we can trust one another. We just need to do it. It takes care of a lot of human need of simply not knowing. Can't do everything on an ad hoc basis. We also make commitments because there is something about our experience of loving one another that sometimes gives rise, right in the middle of it, to a desire to make a commitment. If I awaken in a profound love for you, there is something about that love that wants to be whole, that says, I know I can't gather up my whole life and say I'll share it with you, but I want to do that. And the sign that I want to do that is that I will give you my word that I will do that, or that I will at least try to do that. It's my way of making my love whole, of expressing my love, even though I can't reel out my life as if I didn't always have free choices to make. It's a way of integrating my loves so that I become more and more whole in relation. That is at least what we hope for from making commitments. Finally, we make them because even though freedom is extremely important to us and living a life in process that unfolds always to something new,
We have enough insight into what freedom and process are all about so that we know that keeping all options open makes us feel very free, but it also means we never do anything. It's like the old adage, you can't run in all directions at once. So if you're going to go anywhere, you've got to let, for the time being at least, all the directions but one go. So if we're going to move forward in life, we've got to let go some possibilities and affirm others. Now, along the road, we may have new junctures of possibilities, and that kind of choice happens again and again. But as I keep all options open, all I do is just stand here with options and never really live. But if making a commitment involves entering a relation where I'm bound in a way, obligated, you hold a part of me. If it's a trivial commitment, only a little part of me. But if it's a profound commitment, a great part of me. And in a way, I cut off some options, open other options, and so on. Still, we begin to see that we ought to be very careful about at least the serious commitments that we make. We ought not to just jump into commitments because it would be great to be committed. So we reflect on our commitments and we say, well, some commitments are relative. Some, maybe. One, maybe, is absolute. And we have to get clear how all the others are relative. Some commitments are partial. I'll work for you as long as you have money to pay me. I'll stay with you until you fall asleep. Some commitments are more total. I yield somehow my whole self to you. Behooves us to ask whether anyone or anything is worth that kind of commitment. Some commitments are unconditional. Most commitments are conditional. It's important to be pretty clear on what the conditions are. And any commitment that we make at least allows the possibility along the way of whether or not it holds, whether or not we are justified in breaking it, or justified in changing it, or justified in being released from it. So we have to think about what is it that we, how do we know when a promise I made still binds me or when it doesn't hold anymore? And we need some wisdom about these questions. I can't go into these in much detail, but, for example, traditionally philosophers and theologians have reflected on this sort of thing, and they've said, well, there are sort of standard ways in which you know you're released from a commitment. If you look at the original making of the commitment and you find something right there in its original making that says it doesn't hold, well, then it doesn't hold. What might you find? Well, you might find that there were certain conditions on it, and now those conditions don't hold, so the commitment doesn't hold. Or you might find there was a flaw in the procedure. You were a minor when you made that commitment. It doesn't hold anymore. Minors can't make that kind of commitment. Or the legal commitments, something was missing in the legal requirements. It doesn't hold, etc. Another way in which persons have been known to identify being released from commitments is if the one to whom I give my promise releases me. I give you my word that I will do such and such, and you say, I don't want you to do that anymore. Here's your word back. I'm not holding you to it. That can be a way to be released. I say, I promise you that I will bring you a book tomorrow. You call me up tonight and say, hey, I got the book from somebody else. You don't have to bring it. It'd be silly for me to think, I made that promise. I got to bring the book. Silly, you know. Now, the trouble is these ways of thinking about it don't solve all of our difficult questions. Even to say, well, if you give your word to me and I say you don't need to keep it, maybe I'm released, maybe I'm not. Supposing you're my mother, I'm your daughter, And you look like you don't want to mother me. And I say, okay, I don't want you to mother me anymore. You don't worry about me. You don't have any responsibility. And so, well, that may not release you just because I say I release you. Do you see what I mean? You realize I'm trying to do a lot in a short time. I'm trying to be provocative more than anything else, so I'm oversimplifying a lot of things. But all I'm trying to show is that none of these sort of, they're not like a computer program. You program reasons for being released from commitment, plug in your question, out it comes, yes, you're released, or no, you're not. Doesn't work that way. Life is much more complicated than that when we're dealing with commitments. For most of us, the major questions about being released from commitment have to do with not, well, was there something missing in what I originally intended or my original capability? Not, well, somebody said I didn't have to do it, so I don't have to. But rather, so much has changed. How can I still be bound? I'm not the same person you married. I'm not the same person who accepted a naive faith. I'm not the person who entered, who trained for the medical profession. Or the medical profession has so changed that it isn't anything that calls me vocationally anymore, etc. Is it possible for us to say things have just changed enough that my commitment must not hold? Well, there are ways of thinking about this too. I myself think that there are at least three ways of describing what has changed that at least offers the possibility of our seeing not only that we're justified in being released from the commitment, but maybe that we're obligated to let it go. One is, it becomes impossible to keep it. Back in the Middle Ages, they had a good example for this. People made all sorts of vows that they were going to make pilgrimages to shrines. And the key example always was, well, if the shrine got destroyed by a warring party or something in the meantime, there was no longer any obligation to go and visit it. Our questions of impossibility or possibility aren't quite as simple. But, of course, if it's a question of pure physical possibility, that makes it easier. I promised that I would play racquetball with you this month, but I broke my leg. You know, I'm released. Well, I mean, even if you don't think I am, I am. I know I am. It's silly for me to anguish over, ooh, I broke my leg. But other kinds of, there's a kind of what I call threshold of impossibility in certain relationships, frameworks, structures of commitment. The judgment when that threshold has been reached is very often a very individual judgment. But there are times when it has to be made. This relationship has become so destructive that I cannot go on. Or so much has happened to me that even though I could sort of sheer physically go on in this relationship, and maybe I could without total psychological destructiveness, still I can't turn back. I've already gone far enough along another route that I can't turn back. Now, I'm not giving these examples to say, well, that's an easy way out. I would always say that. Well, of course, we have quasi-infinite capacities for rationalizing our ways out of commitments. But nonetheless, there are situations in our lives when that kind of judgment needs to be made and can be made justifiably. You understand what I mean? Another way of thinking about, second way of thinking about it, is say when the commitment loses the meaning it originally had. Now, this one is very slippery, too, and capable of great rationalization. But what I mean is it loses its point. Its whole purpose is gone. Let's say I agreed to be part of a team that's going to work on housing questions for the homeless in Lincoln, Nebraska. And our team really has done a lot over the years, and we have a lot of structures in place. But at a certain point, I perceive that we've gotten so involved in the bureaucracy, we've lost sight of who the homeless really are. We're doing more harm than good, or we're spinning our wheels. Something new and different has to be done. Now, the team counts on me. And the whole point of making the commitment was, I can't say, well, things have changed. The whole point of the commitment was, look, we'll count on each other. Even if things change, we can count on each other. We'll work this through. We're going to commit. But still, I may reach a point where I say, look, I just don't see it the way you do anymore. We aren't caring for the homeless. My commitment to this team, which had to do with a commitment to the homeless, has lost its point. Now, the test of my sincerity might be whether I just say, forget the homeless, because this team isn't working, or whether I say, I got to find another way to help the homeless. That might be the test. But that's an example. And the same kind of question could be raised in our profound commitments, like marriage, like commitment to a church, etc. And that we might want to talk. I want to leave enough time for questions, because the questions, the judgments that have to be made by us, the nuanced discernment is so much more difficult. But as many of you know, it needs to be made right in the center of our lives, often. The third way of thinking about being released has to do with another obligation taking priority. I said making a commitment, making a promise, is a way to undertake an obligation. Sometimes a brand new obligation, sometimes a renewed one. I mean, like if I already, I may be born into some obligation. Children have obligations to parents. You know, you sort of didn't choose it in the first place, but you have it. But it, at a certain point in a life, it needs ratifying, or it needs a change of focus or whatever. But whatever commitments, whether they're new or ratified, most of them, maybe all of them, but most of them don't hold absolutely. That is to say, supposing I say, I promised you that I would come and meet you for lunch today. On my way to lunch, I pass someone who's dying in the street. I've got to stop and help this dying person, even though I break my promise to you to be at lunch. Now, that's a somewhat facetious example, but it's what I mean when I say just the sheer making of a promise has an obligation entailed to it, but it can be overridden by another obligation. So we have to weigh the ethical priorities. Now, the same may be true even in our profound commitments. Take even our commitment to God. Now, one might say, if one believes in God, if one believes in being related to God in a way that's loving, that is, doesn't see God as a tyrant who judges one all the time, and so in which case one would want to do a lot of negotiating with such a being, but probably not be committed to love with one's whole heart, etc. But supposing one believes in a God that one loves with one's whole heart, and one is absolutely committed. But up to a certain point in one's life, one perceives that the way to love with a whole heart, to grow in a large-hearted and wise love, is, let's say, to keep a whole set of laws that enable one to gather one's spirit. And then one learns that, well, some of those laws help one to grow in love, but some of them don't. Well, one might be not only released from the obligation to those other laws, but be obligated to let them go. Because the larger obligation, which is simply to love with a whole heart and soul and mind and strength, requires one to let go what did at one time serve the love, or looked like it served the love, but doesn't anymore. Well, I'm going to finish with a few comments on not about being released from commitments or the limits of commitments, but what if there's a commitment in our life we want to keep, and we discern that we ought to keep it, to sustain it, to be faithful in it. And we want to keep it in a way that's alive, not, oh, I gritted my teeth and I made it, and I come to my deathbed and I said, I kept that commitment. What if we don't want to do it that way? We know somehow that isn't what we intended when we made. We intended to be alive in it all the while that we were keeping it. Well, I'm just going to make some comments in two different directions. There's sort of two clues, there are a lot more, but two clues to the kind of wisdom we need to stay alive in our committed relationships. One has to do with our insight into human time. We live out our lives in time. You know, we're the kinds of beings that we don't live, however we might want to, we don't live our lives all at once. They're lived out, unfolding in time. And the problem with commitments dying on us often is a problem that something breaks in our experience of time. Now, our experience of you see, time isn't, it's not like space, just one thing right after another, one inch after another. And it's not like a roll of film. You can unroll it and you see the frames. You know. Life, human life isn't like that. It's more like if you cut a tree down, you can see the time in it. It's all in it. You see the rings of the tree. Our time is in us. The meaning of the past is in the present. The meaning of the present will be in the future. You know that on a day-to-day basis. The meaning of the I can't undo the past, we say. Well, no, that's true, but today I choose whether I'm going to be totally bitter about the past or whether I'm going to be repentant about it or whether I'm going to be hopeful about it or whether I'm going to be philosophical about it or whether I'm going to try to make up for it or whether I'm going to try to grow beyond it. You know, the meaning of the past finally still is here and will be in the future. The meaning of the commitment I make today will be in the future. When we say, how is it? What meaning does it have as it unfolds? But our experience of commitments are sometimes, I use the metaphor, it's like if you were driving along, if you're riding in a cart drawn by a horse, and you're driving along, and somehow the horse gets unhitched. And the horse is like your commitment. And you're sitting there in the cart, and you say, yeah, that still is a nice-looking horse, and it's very important for other people, my commitment, it's very important for others, there's nothing wrong with it, and so on. But I'm unhitched from it. It just, it's dead for me. I'm an observer. I'm not a participant anymore. I just sort of watch it, and I just sit still. It's an experience of not having a future in this commitment. We can't stand not having a future. For human beings whose lives is unfolded in time, the sense of a future, not just a fact out there, but an unfolding future, a dynamic future opening up, it's like a sense of future, or hope in the future is, as one philosopher put it, it's like for the spirit, like breathing is for the body. If there's no sense of a future opening up in a given relationship, it's like being suffocated. We can't tolerate not having the lid totally put on the future. That's what despair is. That's what characterizes a lot of the experiences of depression, etc. Well, in our commitments often, that's what it gets like. This is a dead end. It's intolerable. I can't stand it. Well, even having insight into the possibility that that can happen and say, how will I not let that happen in this commitment or try not to let it happen? Well, how do we hold our past and future together? That's the only way to, how do we hold the horse hitched to the carriage? How do we keep the movement going? Well, our connection with our past is through our memory. Our connection with our future is through hope. And somehow commitment relationships have to have built into their fabric concrete, explicit ways of remembering, 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 and hoping, hoping, hoping. It's like the Israelites. The prophets always said to them, they never said just, of course, sometimes they did pretty much say, shape up, you know, shape up. But what they most often says, remember. Remember what? Remember who you are. Remember who you are, meaning remember the covenant relationship that you're in, the promise you received from God, the promise you remember, because that tells you who you are, and that tells you about a future. Remember who you are is what opens the future for you. Well, that's as much as I can say about it. Now, the second clue has to do, very closely connected with that, remembering who you are. And I think I can, in just a couple minutes, describe what I mean by this by appealing to some of the work of the Anglican theologian and writer of stories, Charles Williams. He talks about our experience of what he calls a romantic love. Now, romantic love, he doesn't just mean sort of boy-girl falling in love, etc., but he means any love in which our whole self is involved. So it could be a love of friendship, a love of God, a romantic love that involves a sexual relationship, but any love that involves our whole self. Now, when we love that way, there is usually an original moment, which is called the falling in love, or the original vision. And William says we can make some mistakes about how we interpret the meaning of falling in love. we are aware that we can make mistakes. We can overestimate its importance. And we all kinds of folk common lore says, be careful, wait till you take off the rose-colored glasses, wait till you see what she's really like or he's really like, wait till you see what this church really does, et cetera, et cetera. Don't take it too seriously. William's point is that we also tend to underestimate the importance of the falling in love, the vision that comes in the romantic moment. And to underestimating it, we can make three mistakes interpreting it. First of all, we can think that it will last forever. It won't last forever. The original vision fades. But how we interpret the fading makes all the difference in the world. I can say, now I know more about this person that I love. I may know something. I may know this person has this quirk about him or her. I may know they're awfully boring when they get on such and such. Or they may know they have this one weakness that I didn't see before. I have more information about them. But in fact, I may be seeing less now than I saw in the original vision. If the original vision was a true vision, I was given a special revelation of the beauty of that person, then the fading of the vision may be a problem in my seeing, but not a problem in the beauty of the reality. So the interpretation of that period of disillusionment is all important, because the question of fidelity only rises when the original vision fades. And the question of fidelity is, will I now be faithful in the dark to the light that I once saw? Which means, will I believe that I really saw something? And of course, how will I know for sure that I did? Well, I can't know for sure. It's a great risk. It's a great risk. That's what faith is. I could be wrong. On the other hand, I could say, I could be wrong, I'm not going to risk this, but if I did see something and decide not to be faithful to it in the darkness, then I also lose the possibility of ever seeing the light again. If I risk being faithful and I did see something, in time I will see the light again. And relationships, as they go through time, have that rhythmic process, light, dark, light, dark. The second mistake William says we can make is that we can think that original vision is just for the two of us. If we treat it that way, it closes down in itself. Whereas, in fact, any gift of love of that sort is for everyone. And the third mistake we can make about it is that we can think that it's sufficient in itself. That moment of being in love, however long it lasts, nothing more could supersede it. It's full in itself. But as William said, it's really a vision not of what we already are, but of what we can become together. Well, I'm going to end with that and say our problems of commitment run deep, but the stakes are high because the possibilities in them are great. Sometimes we must let our promised loves go and let their frameworks go. Sometimes we must live them to the end. Discerning which choice is called for and possible in a given situation is a complex matter. In the end, the goal of life is more than just breaking commitments. The goal of life has something to do with keeping some of them. Thank you.
Today, University Forum has presented the Gilbert L. Stark Professor of Christian Ethics at the Yale University Divinity School, Margaret Farley. She spoke on problems and possibilities in personal commitment. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.